You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 22nd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the question of Mirandizing the lone living suspect, the Boston Marathon bombings. Meanwhile, continued to be overlooked, the far more deadly explosion in Texas. The reasons behind that, far fewer demands for resources and curtailing our way of life when it comes to a tragedy that took the lives of at least 14 people now, injuring 200. Also, more news from last week. Continued fallout on that Reinhart-Rogoff study. And New York City, almost half of residents in New York City now living at the poverty rate or within 150% of the poverty rate. Story from last week about a decision that the Boy Scouts have sort of tentatively half made. We will discuss that. We've got a lot to talk about. Also, today is Earth Day. Ladies and gentlemen, you can do something other than, I don't know, recycling a bottle. At the very least, go to majority.fm. I mean, that's the thing. It's Earth Day at this point. Politico, I think, was sending out their news email newsletter celebrating Earth Day, sponsored by the American Petroleum Institute. I mean, honestly. But head over to majority.fm. You can find a link there to provide. Today is the last day of public comments, or a window for public comments regarding Keystone XL pipeline. So head over to majority.fm. We've got a link there. You can go and submit your public comment. Let's start off with one story that has nothing to do with anything, but I enjoyed it. And after the week that we had last week, it is...
It's a good story for that. Yes.
Sort of nice to have one positive story out there. Oh, I also have another story that's sort of disturbing but also funny, involving the George W. Bush Museum. But before we get to that and talk about this issue of Mirandizing and, of course, the rather predictable chest pounding from the right wing about how we need to essentially shut the country down in pursuit of, I guess, potential Chechen terrorists. Rand Paul is now, I guess, advocating no more Chechen immigration in this country. It's just going to be a race to see which one of these lunatics can sort of get to full-on lunacy first. But before we get there, this is a story. A student at George Washington High School, and this is from last week, we missed it. A student from George Washington High School in Charleston, West Virginia, is seeking an injunction in Kanawha Circuit Court against the school's principal last week after she alleges he threatened to call the college where she's been accepted and tell them that she has a bad character. And why? Because she spoke up in public and to the press, I guess, about an assembly that the principal set up at the school. Her name is Caitlin Campbell. She is the student body vice president. She refused to go to this assembly where the Christian speaker, and I think that's sort of a narrow definition for what she does, Pam Stenzel, told students that condoms weren't safe, made some of the students cry by saying that they were 10 times more likely to contract a disease or end up sterile or dead if they take birth control. If your mom gives you birth control, she probably hates you. She was one freshman student said she was attacking and bashing the girls more. She was saying that it was all our faults. She was just crazy. She said things like, it's your parents' fault for putting you on birth control, and that birth control makes you more sexually active and more likely to get STDs. So this student, Caitlin Campbell, a senior, basically spoke to CNN. They spoke to the local papers saying that the principal, a guy named George Allenbacher, was knowingly psychologically abusing students. And so she's telling this to, I guess, the local newspaper, and ends up CNN picks up the story. And so Allenbacher calls her into her office, and Campbell has been saying that, look, West Virginia has the ninth highest pregnancy rate in the U.S., I should be able to be informed in my school what birth control is and how I can get it. With the policy at GW under George Allenbacher, information about birth control and sex education has been suppressed. Our nurse wasn't allowed to talk about where you can get birth control for free in the city of Charleston. So Allenbacher calls the student into his office and said, I am disappointed in you. This is according to her relation of the exchange. I am disappointed in you. How could you go in the press without telling me? He then allegedly threatened to call her college, where she's been accepted, and tell them about her actions. How would you feel if I called your college and told them what a bad character you have and what a backstabber you are? This is according to the complaint been filed with the circuit court, where the injunction is being filed. According to the lawyer, we simply want to make sure that my clients and other students expressing their opinions are protected for exercising their First Amendment rights. No student should be concerned about their future for publicly expressing their opinion. Well, just to give you a sense of how dim this principle turns out to be. The college where Caitlin Campbell has been accepted is Wellesley College in Massachusetts, perhaps one of the most liberal, progressive, all women's colleges in the country. Not perhaps, certainly one of them. And Wellesley tweeted, I guess this was just the other day, Caitlin Campbell, Wellesley is excited to welcome you this fall. So I'm surprised that after this event, they haven't said, oh, and incidentally, you will pay nothing for your 4 years here. We've just made you a trustee of the university.
It's like you think of all those parents, especially in the Northeast, who are so anxious about getting their kids into good schools and are always coming up with different schemes to pass resumes.
Right.
And they're like, how can our daughter get into a
what
conflict
extracurricular
with a moronic principal?
Yes. There you go, folks. You can only imagine now, like, there's like literally schools like Smith is now trying to woo her away from Wellesley. There's colleges lined up across the country basically saying, we will give you, trying to outbid each other for this student to attend. Unbelievable.
How stupid do you have to be?
It's
that principal?
Unbelievable. West Virginia, this school. Man. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about, we're not going to recount too much of what by now you probably know, the timeline and what happened there. But we are going to talk about specifically this, which we had touched on, I believe, on Friday. The decision by the Department of Justice and the Obama administration to hold off on Mirandizing this suspect in the Boston Marathon, the implications of it, how they have come to this decision, and whether or not this ultimately may be challenged in court for the first time. We will also talk about the wisdom or the problem of shutting down a city in this instance and what it can lead to. That and more. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. There was a great piece written by Richard Kim in The Nation. And he starts by saying, ask yourself, do you know the name of any of the victims killed in the West Chemical Fertilizer Company disaster? Do you know how many of them there were? Their ages, aspirations, what they looked like, whether they left behind children, or what messages they last posted on Facebook? Do you know if there is an explanation yet for what caused the explosion? He goes on to say you probably don't know the answer to at least all of those, if not most of those questions. Yet 14 people died, many of them first responders, 200 people injured, many of them seriously. And he goes on to write, we pay orders of magnitude more attention to the victims of terrorism than we do to the over 4,500 Americans killed each year while on the job. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis once put it, every day in America, 13 people go to work and never come home. He says, let's imagine that instead of sending a handful of investigators from the ATF and the Chemical Safety Board to West Texas, we marshaled every local, state, and federal resource available to discover the exact sequence of events that led to that explosion. Imagine that the question why became so urgent that the nation simply could not rest until it had overdetermined the answers. We discovered that OSHA hadn't inspected the plant in 28 years. Did this play a role in the disaster? If it's found that the company owns the plant, Ader Grain, violated safety regulations as it had at yet another facility, we might call it criminal negligence and attribute culpability. But would we ascribe ideology? And what ideology would we indict? Deregulation? Austerity? Capitalism? Would we write headlines that say officials seek motive in Texas fertilizer explosion? And could we name profit as that motive in the same way that we might name, say, Islam as the motive for terrorism? Would we arrest the plant's owners, deny them their Miranda rights, and seek to try them in an extra legal tribunal outside the Constitution, as Senator Lindsey Graham has suggested we treat citizen Dokar Tsarnaev? Would we call for a ban on the production of ammonium nitrate in a hideous ammonia? would we say that gaps and loopholes in our nation's agricultural policies were responsible for the tragedy, as Senator Chuck Grassley has suggested about immigration in the Boston bombing case? No, we won't. Because even if the West fertilizer plant disaster is ultimately as understood as something more than just an accident, it will still be taken as the presumed cost of living in a modern industrialized economy. When it comes to terrorism, we have the opposite response. We launch wars against other countries, denude the Constitution, and create massive state bureaucracies for espionage, covert operations, and assassinations. Since 9/11, it's become political imperative that our nation must express zero tolerance for terrorism, even though, like workplace fatalities, terrorism has been with us long before globalization lent it a more exotic and threatening provenance. To the problem of violence, there ought to be a path between callous indifference and total social warfare. That's why the miserable and absolute failure of gun control legislation in the Senate just 2 days after the Boston bombing and on the same day of the West explosion was especially galling. The deaths of those school children were linked to the fate of more than 30,000 victims of gun violence each year, and the impulse was to act was channeled through our democratic system, where an overwhelming majority of Americans and majority of the U.N. Senate expressed support for new gun laws, which were nonetheless defeated. So, America, here's your scorecard for the week of April 15th, 2013. Callous indifference 2, total warfare 1. I mean, I think when we look back on that week, and we see how America reacts to a massive explosion that was surely preventable. The question is, how far will we go in the context of providing regulation? How much profit are we willing to destroy, essentially, to prevent those type of explosions, to prevent the deaths of those 15 people, the injuries of those 200. We know the answer is in terms of what we're willing to do to attempt to prevent terrorism. We will shut down an entire city for a day. $1 billion worth of economic activity. Ongoing diminishment of economic activity in Boston. Copley Square, all those stores are apparently still shut. We know that we're willing to push the boundaries in terms of Mirandizing criminal suspects. We know what we have done to our criminal justice system in our capacity to hold prisoners for 3.5 years without charges in the case of Jose Padilla. We know that we're willing to build secret prisons and gulags and hold people who we know are no threat to us indefinitely in Guantanamo. We know that we're willing to slough off the spying on American citizens, whether they are college students or they're in their places of worship, if they're Muslim. We know that we're willing to empower police departments, like the New York City Police Department, to spy on people well out of their jurisdiction and within their jurisdiction. We know that we're willing to prosecute whistleblowers who report that the NSA is not only not effectively finding intelligence, but doing so because they want to privatize the system. We know that we're willing to hold people prisoner like Bradley Manning, charge them with espionage, charge them as if they were spies, as opposed to someone who was whistleblowing stuff to major news outfits. I mean, the list goes on and on. What we're willing to do to attempt to prevent terrorism, we're willing to provide literally millions upon millions of dollars to police departments so that they can buy, and I've been corrected by a listener, we'll talk about that in a minute, but armored vehicles, not tanks, and devices that will incapacitate crowds through audio, audio cannons, essentially. We know what we're willing to do that in terms of preventing terrorism. To fundamentally chip away at our civil liberties. But when it comes to preventing explosions, if there's any diminishment of profit, then that's completely off the table. The millions of dollars that have been spent by just the fertilizer lobby, by the petrochemical lobby, to roll back the power of the EPA and of legislation to regulate these types of facilities. The money that has been starved from OSHA to make sure that people are working in safe plants. The pressure that's been put on the EPA not to exercise its ability to go out and investigate these types of facilities, even though there's been a record of safety violations by this own company, by this facility. We apparently don't have the political will to do that. We don't have the political will to say, hey, if you purchase a gun, you, in any context, you need to make sure there needs to be a background check. Apparently, what I've seen in terms of the reporting, those two terrorists did not have licenses to carry their weapons. We don't know where they got them. We don't know any of the details about that. But there's no record of them having a license to do so. But we don't have the political will to do anything about these problems. I want to play this. Well, let's talk about why there's a piece by Emily Bazelon in Slate, I think it is, as to why you should care if Dzhokhar Tsarnaev has his Miranda rights read. And we know, and we talked about this briefly last week. I think it was on Monday or Tuesday night, where a former FBI agent on All In, Hayes' show, had said they won't be read their Miranda rights because of the public safety exception. Now, understand that 1966, the Supreme Court said that suspects in a criminal case, and remember, this will be tried in a criminal court. Suspects in a criminal case need to be read their rights. They need to know what rights the Constitution grants them. The right to remain silent, the knowledge that anything they say can be used against them in a court of law, the right to have an attorney. And in 1984, there was a case that the Supreme Court in the United States heard that carved out an exemption to when a suspect needed to be read his or her Miranda rights. It was in the context of a case where a man was suspected of rape. The victim said that her assailant had a gun. The guy had an empty holster. And so the cops had every reason to believe that the guy did have a gun, that it was somewhere else. And for the sake of public safety, before they Mirandized him, they asked him where the gun was. And the exception was allowable, and anything they found in terms of finding that gun was still admissible, because someone could find that gun, shoot themselves. Someone could find that gun, shoot someone else. There was a public safety exemption here. In 2002, the FBI messed up, apparently, the interrogation of Zacharias Moussaoui, the 20th 9/11 hijacker who never got onto the planes. Former FBI Special Agent Colleen Rowley wrote a memo pleading, the quote, that if prevention rather than prosecution is to be our new main goal, an objective she had agreed with, we need more guidance on when we can apply the Quarles public safety, Quarles was the case in 1984, public safety exception to the Miranda's Fifth Amendment requirements. So in other words, we needed to know that in that instance that we had the ability, because it was an imminent threat to public safety, to not Mirandize this guy. Following the apprehension of the Christmas Day bomber, the FBI invoked the public safety exemption and interrogated him. They stopped the interrogation after 50 minutes. They then Mirandized him after getting what they said was valuable information. The suspect then asked for a lawyer, stopped talking. Later, he ended up talking with his attorney after being Mirandized and gave them valuable information. But a significant period of time later, after he was treated at the hospital. Then you had the Times Square bomber. He was interrogated without Miranda warnings. The FBI claimed it did get useful information. Following the time that he was then Mirandized, he kept talking. At that time in 2010, holders at the Justice Department wanted the Congress to take up a bill so that he had statutory authority to expand this exemption to the Miranda rights, to expand the definition of public safety to something that was not imminent. You may recognize that that conceit. We see that now with who is an imminent threat in terms of being chosen to be assassinated by drones or any other means, I guess, that matter. Congress did not take up this measure, so the Department of Justice wrote a memo essentially expanding this exemption on their own, unilaterally. It's never been tested, never signed off by a court. There may be exceptional cases in which, although relevant public safety questions have been asked, agents nonetheless conclude that continued unwarned interrogation is necessary to collect valuable and timely intelligence not related to any immediate threat, and that the government's interest in obtaining this intelligence outweighs the disadvantages of proceeding with unwarned interrogation. The courts may yet have the opportunity to do this. The FBI may, in fact, harm their chances of getting a prosecution if they go beyond what a court would find reasonable in this instance. But remember, this is setting a precedent. Every time we do something like this, it is setting a precedent that gets expanded and expanded. We know from reporting last week or the week before in McClatchy that the drone program is no longer and has not been used solely for people who represent even an expanded definition of imminent threat to the United States. It is used essentially as a bargaining chip, where we offer the services of using our drones to assassinate other people on behalf of other governments to get things from other governments that we want. Maybe it's intelligence. Maybe it's, I don't know, rights to do a pipeline. I mean, who knows if it can be considered national security? This is the way that you expand the destruction of these rights. It doesn't happen at once. It happens bit by bit by bit. And as to the value of not Mirandizing, here's a snippet from Fox News, where a former FBI agent comes on and says, well, let's play this clip. It surprises the hell out of the Fox News reporter, I think, to the extent that she fully gets what this guy is saying. Go ahead.
And for more on this now, we're going to bring in our next guest, Chris Voss, retired FBI special agent, hostage negotiator, and terrorism expert. He also is the managing director of Insight Security. We've talked quite a few times over the last few days, Chris. It's great to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Jenna.
Let's pick up off of what Catherine was just reporting on there, which is a debate about whether or not the suspect should be read his Miranda rights. Moving past some of the politics of it, because it seems to be getting a little political. As a former member of the FBI, how does whether or not the suspect is read his Miranda rights influence or impact your investigation?
Well, it really becomes irrelevant. I mean, good rapport-based interviewers, interrogators, who are the ones that are the most effective? I mean, the FBI doesn't do that because we're nice. We do that because it worked. And rapport-based interviewers, Miranda, they can read that and then continue the relationship. It's not a big problem. It's not a major obstacle. It's almost irrelevant.
Really? Because we're hearing that it's such a major issue about whether we get to the bottom of this investigation. So what should we consider as we continue to hear this debate ongoing over the next several days?
It really doesn't make that much difference to the interviewers, and especially the particular group of profilers that they've developed at Quantico, at the FBI Academy, CERG. This is not terribly relevant. They can sit down with these people. They can interview them. They look for behavioral cues. They look for a way to establish a relationship so that the individual starts to talk. That's it. They do it because it's effective. And you can even interview people occasionally with a lawyer in the room. And the lawyer, if the individual starts to be deceptive in the interview, will start to tell the person to tell the truth. And so Miranda, and it's much ado about nothing, in my view.
It's interesting. It's nice to have your perspective after more than 20 years with the FBI.
There you have it. He's coming on to say that in terms of the investigation, Mirandizing does not in any way inhibit our ability to get information. And he goes as far to say that, you know, sometimes a lawyer actually helps us. So all we are left with is really the decision to strip us of our constitutional rights. And for the benefit of, well, at least in terms of the investigation, nothing. So I don't know that we will hear this this type of testimony any more than we heard, you know, torture doesn't really help either. You get much more out of building a rapport with people. That's simply the way it works. And I think this FBI agent was one of the same guys who said that, right? I mean,
I don't know specifically, but I think Jane Mayer had a piece.
Yeah, it was Ali Safan,
yeah,
who was the FBI agent who said the torture got in the way of us collecting more information.
Well, no, like literally to the point that you would have a rapport established with a guy, information was coming, then guys came in, disrupted the interrogation that they were doing, tortured him, and that was it.
Right. And then you're back to maybe even worse than square one. And I want to talk about the slippery slope. You know, we hear people call in and say, you know, you can't take my gun rights away because it's going to be a slippery slope. I had a conversation with my neighbor upstate about in New York State now, all private exchanges of gun sales, every one, even if you're going to sell it to your neighbor, you got to go down to a gun dealer and get a background check. And my neighbor was like, you know, if two people know each other, they're probably not going to do it. That may be the case, but the law is then even that much more effective. Because the problem is that a lot of times you're selling guns to people that you don't know. And that's the problem. And we have a Supreme Court ruling that has edified, for better or for worse, this interpretation that people have a private right to the Second Amendment. No legislation is going to change that. I got an email from a listener, longtime member, listener from the Air America days. I've been in law enforcement for 12 years, since before 9/11. I usually start your day by listening to your podcast as I start my patrol route. I have to take issue with a couple of things that come up. First is, you refer to the militarization of police and the tanks that you saw in Boston. Unless you saw something I didn't, what you saw was police in protective gear. Some of them were driving in armored vehicles like the Lenco Bearcat that are built in Massachusetts. Just because I put a helmet on my head doesn't mean that I want to intimidate you, hurt you, or violate your civil rights. All I want is not to be hurt or killed when someone hits me in the head. There is, and I think that's a perfectly legitimate perspective. And the implication is not that any individual police officer wants to do this. The implication isn't even necessarily that police departments want to do this. He goes on to write, those armored vehicles might have cost too much money, but building them gave jobs to Americans and protected those officers in Boston from people that were murderous bomb throwers. We protect money with armored cars, so why can't we use them to protect our own lives? All valid. Yet, we know that when the police came in contact with these two guys and they were throwing those pipe bombs and they were throwing pressure cooker, that there were no up-armored vehicles there. In fact, the only times these things were sent around were when they were just patrolling the streets, or when they were streets, or when they were cordoning off the streets. And yes, police officers should have protection. But should every city in the country have these? I mean, we know they have them like in Keene, New Hampshire. We're able to buy one of these up-armored, you don't want to call them a tank, it doesn't have a turret. One of these up-armored vehicles. Should every town in the country have one? Why not? I mean, we are spending millions of dollars. We have LRADs in some cities. There are instances where, you know, that guy in L.A., I can't remember when it was, but went on a huge shooting spree. And cops were taken out, not Dorner, I'm talking years and years ago. But there is a fine line, it seems to me, between making sure that we protect police to the extent that we can, and then providing huge sums of Department of Homeland Security money that incentivize and basically force these police departments to buy as much military hardware, frankly, as they can. And we start to create an environment in this country. I mean, I tweeted over the weekend, Massachusetts at least once repealed the seatbelt laws. The legislature passed the seatbelt law and then voters repealed it because they were so offended about their personal liberties being so curtailed as to being forced to wear a seatbelt. Now that sounds really sort of almost cute. It seems ridiculous. Is there anybody who would really make a strong argument now that our civil liberties are curtailed by seatbelts? But obviously the vast majority, or not the vast, I mean the majority of people who participated in that referendum certainly thought it was. And so the culture has changed. We now value the safety that seatbelts provide for us and the reduced car insurance rates and the reduction in cost to provide medical services and the drop in highway fatalities. And we've absorbed that. But now have we absorbed the notion that every town should have their own up-armored vehicle? That we should be able to shut down a city when there was zero evidence of an existential threat? I mean, if there was reason to believe that these terrorists possessed some type of dirty bomb, if there was reason to believe that these terrorists had the ability to create a network where they were blowing up subway stations, multiple subway stations, you know, I think you might get into have an argument there. But, I mean, look at the examples from around the world. In London. In Jerusalem. Look at what took place in the Olympics in Atlanta. We've never done this before. Then there seems to be absolutely no dissent about shutting down all the public transportation, basically saying to people, you cannot go to work today. Yeah, there were people who got out and walked around, and I guess people wanted the day off. Maybe that's one of the upshots. But you shut down a city in this way? What if there was even like, I mean, what threat would you now say we couldn't do this for? The Washington sniper? Should we have shut down all of D.C. at that time? For how long? They were actively shooting people for weeks. I don't know. These are all questions that seem to be answered. And they are all part and parcel of the same thing, in my estimation.
Isn't it sort of interesting, too, that they found him that, like, literally minutes after they ended that whole...
Well, that's the other... I mean...
Like, a person who was told to stay in his house went outside and saw him.
The other argument is, of course, that, I mean, from a practical standpoint, the fact is that it is a more effective crime-fighting tool, obviously, to not have people stay inside like that. If the city had been shut down since Monday and those photos had been released and no one had gone to work and no one had done anything, I don't think you would have caught those people at all. As it was still by chance that they stumbled into a robbery and they got panicked. So I don't know. I mean, these are all things to be thinking about at this point. While, you know, Lindsey Graham is out there basically saying, our homeland is a battlefield now. Well, more people died in Texas, West Texas. More people die at the workplace. More people die on our roads. The whole point is that these guys, with the most amount of malicious intent you could have, were only able to do this in terms of genuine, in terms of being able to kill people. And in terms of property destruction, they were able to terrorize the city. But what they were actually able to do, that's the whole point, right? Is that these guys could never have gotten a dirty bomb. They didn't even have the wherewithal to get serious explosives. And had they, maybe they would have been tracked down. So, you know, the criminal justice system works. And they weren't found because they were being spied upon. The FBI went and investigated one of these guys on behalf of the Russian government a couple of years ago. That still didn't stop anything. The guy was almost kicked out of his, he had been radicalized, but he was almost kicked out of his,
mosque?
Of his mosque because
Are
of the
you
way
thinking
that
of the outburst he had.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he was during, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and the, imam compared, Martin Luther King Jr. to the prophet, and he had a public outburst.
He had a public outburst, and he was basically sat down and said, "You can't act this way." So he obviously, he clearly wasn't radicalized by his mosque. If anything, they were a moderating factor on him. Didn't work. Would it have made a difference if there had been a if that the whole place had been wired and they had been aware of that outburst? Absolutely not. Of course not. These happen all the time. I've been in temples where people get mad at the rabbi for espousing some type of overly overt pro-Israel.
Well, let's be honest, Sam. The Jews will never do anything like that.
I guess you're right. Nor the Christians.
They never do anything like that. They're all good people. Jews, Christians never engage in any sort of violence of any sort.
Right. So, I mean, it's about trade-offs. And I appreciate we need to we have police officers who go out there. They risk their lives. And we need to do everything we can while still to protect them, but by still maintaining some semblance of not living in a militarized state. And that both is in appearance and in practice. The reality is we could protect policemen even more by monitoring every single individual, by having every block with video cameras everywhere, by having retina scans every time you get on the subway, by, of course.
Isn't that email you read where the person said that they wear that gear because they don't want someone, they're worried someone's going to bash them in the head or something like that. I mean, doesn't that also speak to another problem with police departments? I mean, okay, in a situation like this, okay, I understand. But they're using this gear for so much
now. Well, that's the problem.
Like, I mean, that's how our police are being trained to think, not let's work with the community. They're out there thinking, I'm worried I'm going to get bashed in the head. I'm worried everyone's a villain. Everyone's,
I will tell you that.
Everyone's out to hurt me.
In the lead up to the RNC in 2004, I had a pretty decent relationship with a guy who I believe at the time was a detective. And he was saying that what they were being told, and he believed it, this was going to be the WTO. They were going to be planting bombs. There was going to be Molotov cocktails. There was going to be all sorts of violence. These guys were ready to go. They were hyped up. Same thing happened with Occupy. Look, if you are facing a situation where a guy is held up with a semi-automatic weapon and has hostages, by all means, bring out the shields. Bring out the full riot gear or the full body armor. Bring out, if you're in a your armored vehicle. But the problem is these things are there all the time, and they got to get used. That is the problem. So then you have LRADs being brought out to get people to disperse from a park where no public safety issue is happening. That's the reality. Nothing that the Department of Health couldn't deal with. That's the problem, is that it gets used in situations that do not require those things. And I understand excess caution, but at one point there's a tipping point. I could keep my son in a plastic bubble and roll him through the streets to the extent that I ever let him out of the house. But he wouldn't be able to live a life. It would eventually impact him. So there needs to be a balance. And I think our balance is out of whack. 25 years ago, seatbelts are, you know, the death knell of our civil liberties. But shutting down the whole city? Eh. I mean, what wouldn't it take to shut down a city at this point? Rash of bank robberies? No, I'm serious. I'm not being facetious. What, I mean, what does it take at that point? Dangerous guy escapes from prison? Considered armed? I don't know. I don't know. All right, we're going to take a break, head into the better half of the program. In the better half of the program, we will talk a little bit more about, well, we will obviously get to the Bush Museum. And I understand that the impetus, particularly if you're one of the nation's worst presidents in the history of this country, of wanting to rewrite history. And but this is really, really impressive. So I'm the decider. You be deciding. We'll talk more about this. If you have any comments on any of what we talked about, I should also add that in the email, which I don't think is related, but I think this listener was trying to get it off his chest. He's none too excited about Jimmy Reefer Cake glamorizing, glorifying marijuana. But the thing is, he says, this is where, I mean, I think this is something he has to say, obviously. Look, if you're a cop, you don't want to go out there and you want to be protected. Totally reasonable. Totally reasonable. I think he's on shakier ground in terms of the marijuana glorification. He says, say what you will about the drug war, I am fine with legalization. He says, currently, however, the system that provides most of the marijuana the U.S. exploits impoverished Mexicans is harmful to the environment. Absolutely. Cartels force Mexican laborers backpack large bales of drugs through the desert at the border, drop them off in national forests where they live in tents and create marijuana gardens in the pristine wilderness. Until it's legalized, using marijuana is the same kind of exploitation as buying products made in sweatshops or using rainforest wood. I think there's some truth to that. But the fact of the matter is that I think you have far more influence over the ending of this prohibition in the use of marijuana or the glorification of it or the advocacy of it than you would in abstaining, and because there's a lot of people don't even care about the environment. There's a lot of people don't care about where they get their stuff, obviously. I mean, look, you could say a lot of similar things about the, you know, your iPad in terms of exploitation. That's the way that Jimmy Reefer Cake addresses that. But I think there's a lot more room for debate as to the value of that, putting it in every song. Be that as it may, let's take a break. The number is 646-257-3920. The IM is up if you want to... I am me, folks. It is your membership that makes this show possible. Please become a member today at majority.fm. We need your support. We really do need your support. I cannot make that point any more clear than I have, although I guess maybe we could. We could have dark days on the Majority Report. Maybe we'll do one this week or next week. All right, folks, seeing the better half.